Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Movie idol, actor, and activist Paul Newman won hearts on and off the big screen. He played the alcoholic, the convict, the cowboy, the lover, the lawyer. In Cool Hand Luke, The Hustler, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Verdict, Nobody's Fool, and more, he wrestled with his own beauty, helped define American manhood, and reached out of the movie theater deep into the tough parts of life. He died last Friday at 83. We're not finished talking or thinking about Paul Newman this hour on Point, remembering icon, actor, activist, Paul Newman. You can join the conversation. Did his blue eyes make you weak in the knees way back when? In what film did his career help you understand what it means to mature? In art, in life. Joining me today from New York is Mark Harris. He's a columnist for Entertainment Weekly and is author of the book Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood. Mark Harris, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Middletown, Connecticut, is Janine Basinger. She's chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University and author of The Star Machine and A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930-1960. Janine, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly and an inveterate moviegoer. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom, Mark, and Janine.
Jack Beatty, give us a moment from Paul Newman, a moment that sticks with you. Dead at 83, and it's kind of hard to believe he was around for so long, left such an impression. A moment in your movie-going life, Jack.
Well, to me, his great performance is as Fast Eddie Felsen in the first 1961 Hustler. I think it's a character to put with Willie Loman, the American, the fellow that wants to be first, the champ, but who has to go out and get some character before he can be a true champ. And the film is about his getting of that character, and it's just a spectacular film. And you know, I think it's no coincidence that his two, in my mind, two best performances as Fast Eddie Felsen and then in 1963 as HUD were in black and white, where the blue eyes weren't there to distract you with the beauty. That in some strange way, his great talent as an actor, I think, came through most forcefully when his beauty was there, but subordinate to the medium.
Black and white, but still moving in its way. Here's a little clip, and we'll hear a lot of Paul Newman in this hour, but from The Hustler, 1961, as you say, Jack, you played the small-time pool hustler Fast Eddie Felsen here picnicking with his girlfriend Sarah Packard, played by Piper Laurie. Fast Eddie Newman explains the thrill he gets from playing pool.
Well, I'm gone. I'm really gone. I feel like a jockey must feel. He's sitting on his horse. He's got all that speed and that power underneath him. He's coming into the stretch. The pressure's on him. And he knows. He just feels when to let it go and how much. Because he's got everything working for him. Timing, touch. It's a great feeling, boy. It's a real great feeling. When you're right, and you know you're right. It's like all of a sudden I got oil in my arm. Pool cue's part of me. You know, it's a pool cue. It's got nerves in it. It's a piece of wood. It's got nerves in it. You feel a roll of those balls? You don't have to look. You just know.
You just know, says Paul Newman in 1961's The Hustler. Mark Harris, it takes us way back in time in a big hurry there. The affectation, the kind of sound of that time. You've written that in many ways, Paul Newman came into the biz in the shadow of Marlon Brando, and it kind of split in the streams of what American men were supposed to be in life for on the screen.
Yeah, I think in the 1950s, when Paul Newman first made his appearance, Brando had already become a big star with On the Waterfront and A Streetcar Named Desire. And most of the men you saw in movies back in the 50s were either real he-men like, you know, Kirk Douglas or John Wayne, yeah, or this new kind of very, very vulnerable, tortured, wounded guy like James Dean or Montgomery Clift. And And the interesting thing about Brando is that he was able to walk down the middle of that to create something new by being very masculine and very vulnerable and readable. And at the beginning of his career, Newman was really seen as kind of a lesser Brando, as someone who was going to walk in his shadow. And I think Jack is exactly right that The Hustler is the movie where he really started to completely forge his own identity, and also right that in those early years when he was so astonishingly good-looking, his best movies were the black-and-white ones, The Hustler and HUD. But I'd also say that to Newman's credit, even when he was great-looking, there was no great-looking actor who was ever less interested in the fact that he was great-looking. And as he got older and more experienced, and I think an even deeper and richer actor than he was in The Hustler and HUD, he learned how to play against his looks. When you look at a movie from the 80s like The Verdict, which I think is one of his greatest later performances, he really lets himself go. He's still got the blue eyes, but he looks worn out, jowly, sagging, weak. That was the kind of guy that Paul Newman loved to play, much more than he liked to play winners.
HUD was a breakthrough for him in 1963. He played the brash, self-centered cowboy, lives on a cattle ranch with his very principled rancher father, Homer Bannon, played by Melvin Douglas. Here's a scene where Paul Newman, who plays HUD, shows his seductive side as he tries to woo the family's housekeeper, the very attractive Alma, played by Patricia Neal. She starts off talking about her no-good ex-husband who left her and took all the money.
He's probably up at Vegas or Reno right now, dealing at night, losing it all back in the daytime.
Oh, man like that sounds no better than a heel.
Aren't you all?
Honey, don't go shooting all the dogs because one of them's got fleas.
I was married to Ed for 6 years. The only thing he was ever good for was to scratch my back where I couldn't reach it.
You still got that itch?
Off and on.
Well, let me know when it gets to bothering you.
HUD with Paul Newman, 1963. Janine, give us a sense of where this actor came from. I mean, we read now, and I never knew. Father was a Jewish sporting goods shop owner in Ohio. Mother, I think, Irish Catholic. Paul Newman kicked around theater in Wisconsin, Yale Drama School, and then the Actors Studio in New York. But how did he get into the Hollywood star machine that you've written about, and what was his relationship with it?
Well, the thing is, he is interesting because he is a college educated. I mean, he's a graduate of Kenyon, and then, of course, he went to the Yale Drama School, and he had serious acting credentials from Broadway and Summer Stock when he was brought out to Hollywood, obviously because of his looks. I mean, I really liked what Jack said about the black and white. It's something I'd never thought of. I mean, it's fascinating to think that he escaped his own beauty. I mean, if you want to think about a movie star, you know, really getting out from under being the best-looking sex symbol of his time, you usually associate that kind of thing with women, and they never get out from under it. But he did. But he didn't let the system take him over. The first movie that he was put into at Warner Brothers when he came to Hollywood was, I think, an absolutely agreed-upon stinker, The Silver Chalice.
Yeah.
One critic said the Marx Brothers would have been proud, especially Groucho. And, you know, it is kind of a hoot. But he was unhappy. He was cast for his looks. And he was under Brando's shadow. And that was a huge shadow at that time. And he just didn't want that kind of career. And he went back to Broadway to appear again in theater in Desperate Hours. He fought the system from the beginning. He managed to find a way to be in Hollywood, be a star, be a leading man, and still grow and take control of his own career, which is unusual.
How deliberate, how conscious was that fight, Janine? I mean, was he thinking early on as this beautiful young man, I may be a prisoner of my beauty if I'm not careful. The star machine may eat me alive. Was it at, you know, at the front of his mind? Was it that fully articulated? Do you know?
It seems that in interviews over the years, he has repeatedly talked about that issue, that he wanted to do serious work. He did, and you know, he proved it by moving away from Hollywood. He didn't stay in Hollywood. By the early 60s, he came to live in Connecticut. He kept other things going for himself, and he just always talked. And I think the proof is in the pudding also. When you look at his career, as Mark was saying, you see that growth. You see the willingness not to make it be about his looks. The fact is, you know, his career could have been much less interesting and much shorter, and he still could have been a huge movie star icon that we'd be sitting here talking about. But he did such interesting and unusual things, and he tried, he took risks, and he didn't really have to take those risks to be a big star.
Jack Beatty, to be fair, though, to be honest, I remember way, way into his career, women just sighing and literally going weak at the knees over Paul Newman. I mean, you just said the name, and women's faces would kind of glaze over with happiness.
Well, I have an anecdote about that. This is a story I heard from a friend, a woman that she worked with in New York City. Some years ago, this woman was in line to get an ice cream, a very hot day in an ice cream store, and behind her was Paul Newman. And, of course, she kept looking and kept she couldn't even follow what day it was. Finally, she got her ice cream, and she sat down with it and was still just looking at Paul. And she turned to the women she was with, and she says, "What did I do with my ice cream cone?" And Paul walked by her, and he said, "You put it in your pocketbook."
There's the Paul Newman effect, the ice cream at the bottom of the purse. We'll go out with music from 1960's Exodus with Paul Newman. Mark Harris, Janine Basinger, Jack Beatty, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with much more. We're remembering Paul Newman this hour, icon, actor, activist, entrepreneur, and his extraordinary career in movies and beyond. We're joined by Mark Harris, columnist for Entertainment Weekly and author of Pictures at a Revolution. Janine Basinger is here from Middletown, Connecticut, chair of film studies at Wesleyan University, author of The Star Machine. Jack Beatty's here. 1967 film Cool Hand Luke. Paul Newman plays Luke, of course. The film takes place in a Florida prison camp where Luke has landed after getting caught one night cutting the heads off parking meters. Here in this scene, his dying mother, Arletta, played by Jo Van Fleet, comes to visit to say her final goodbye. Luke thanks her for raising him as a single mom and said he's the only one to blame for the mess he's in.
You've done your best, Arletta. What I've done with myself is my own problem.
No, no, it ain't, Luke. You ain't alone. Everywhere you go, I'm with you. And John, too.
You never thought maybe that's a heavy load?
Why, we always thought you were strong enough to carry it. Was we wrong?
I don't know. Well, things are just never the way they seem, Arletta. You know that. A man's got to go his own way.
Guess I just gotta love you and let go,
I guess.
Paul Newman and Jo Van Fleet, 1967, Cool Hand Luke. Only 2 years later, his big film, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Western about bank robber Butch Cassidy, played by Newman, and his partner, the Sundance Kid, Robert Redford, another beauty. On the run after a botched train robbery, they find themselves trapped at the edge of a canyon in this famous scene, the raging river far below. Sundance Kid, Redford, is gearing up for a gun battle, but Butch, Paul Newman, has a different plan.
No, we'll jump.
Like hell we will.
No, it'll be okay. If the water's deep enough, we don't get squished to death. They'll never follow us.
How do you know?
Would you make a jump like that you didn't have to?
I have to, and I'm not gonna.
Well, we got to, otherwise we're dead. They're just gonna have to go back down the same way they come. Come on.
Just one clear shot, that's all I want.
Come on. We got to.
Up. Get away from me.
Why?
I want to fight them.
They'll kill us.
Maybe.
You want to die?
Do you?
All right. I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
And off they go. You kind of have to see the gorge to make it work, but a whole generation and more certainly did. Mark Harris, I mean, in this film, and maybe even before, this projection of American manhood changing in the hands of Paul Newman. Much more change to come in his career. But how would you say he, I don't know, interacted with that sort of American understanding of what it meant to be a man and how he changed it?
Well, I think you picked a really interesting pivot moment to illustrate in his career. Cool Hand Luke was 67 and was really sort of the peak of his 60s movie stardom. He became, you know, with this anti-heroic portrayal of a kind of a loner prisoner, a sort of icon to a new generation of moviegoers, even though 1967 was sort of the height of the don't trust anyone over 30 generation gap ethos, Paul Newman suddenly clicked for a new generation, even though he was 42 when he made that movie. That didn't seem to register on anyone. But just 2 years later, when he makes Butch Cassidy, for the first time you're seeing him as, in a way, the older leading man. I mean, Redford is definitely the younger guy and possibly even the more beautiful guy in that movie. And you begin to see Newman get more and more interested over the next 10 or 20 years in dismantling this idea of the handsome guy as American hero. I mean, you can see it as early as Hustler and Hud, but, you know, throughout the 70s, which was not necessarily a great movie period for him, and the 80s, which was a great period, you start seeing him play weaker men, more compromised men, men like the hockey coach in Slapshot struggling with a sort of midlife feeling of failure, men like Frank Galvin in The Verdict. You know, he wasn't interested in playing larger-than-life heroes for the most part, even when he played people like Billy the Kid in The Left-Handed Gun or Buffalo Bill Cody in Buffalo Bill and the Indians. He was more interested in kind of cutting them down to size and undercutting the myth than he was in burnishing it.
Jack, what do you make of that shift in the kind of men that got held up? Mark points all the way back to John Wayne and Kirk Douglas, his earlier sort of very rough-and-ready type. Then the anguish type, you know, Montgomery Clift and Brando straddling. Where do you see Newman taking it, Jack?
Well, I think we heard a bit of it in that scene, irony. He was really good at irony, at almost not taking himself seriously in the role or as the character, not quite taking himself seriously, a sort of vein of self-mockery. And I think he injected irony as a form of intelligence. You could just feel that in his roles, which is a subversive, you know, it's not the, you don't go on Mount Rushmore for masculinity with irony. And yet it is one of the most striking things we find about other people, their irony, their way of being not straight even when they seem to be. And he could do that very well.
Janine, earlier in his career, he'd been like Greek or Roman statuary. You know, many of the black and white photographs, he looks kind of like a model that, I don't know, one of those old sculptors would have chosen. But then he's this more complex 40-something now in the 70s. And as Jack says, grabbing onto irony, it seems to me that it's not just Newman at that time doing that all of American culture was turning in that direction.
That's right. We start to turn it upside down, move away from the more traditional concept of the hero, you know, really bringing the anti-hero concept forward and telling stories about American men as failures or looking for a way to live without heroism. And it just becomes more complicated. It reflects the whole culture. The thing is, he was particularly good at it, and because he was so beautiful, it became really etched for us and tremendously meaningful, because if he was the one who was going to do it, you know, it really, you believed in it. Right from Hud, I really see in Hud how he plays him mean. He plays Hud mean and scary. I mean, as a woman, that's a scary man. Tremendously sexy and attractive, you know, the don't go there kind of guy that you always want to go there for.
Right.
And he's not afraid to do it. He doesn't give a little wink-wink to us. It's really okay, everybody underneath here is a warm-hearted, sweet guy, you know, who really... He plays it mean and scary. He was ready, you know, to do that, to be willing to go against loving, heroic male characters.
Though he was still kind of the winking, lovable guy, even a tough guy, at the same time in The Sting, 1973, set in Chicago in the 30s, two professional grifters, Newman and Redford, again here, try to con the mob boss, Doyle Lonergan, played by Robert Shaw. Here's the famous poker game where the mob boss tries to cheat Newman's character, Henry Gondorf, out of his money, only to have Newman win himself by cheating.
I'll call.
4-9. 4 jacks. You owe me 15 grand, pal.
Must have left my wallet in my room.
Don't hand me into that crap. When you come to a game like this, you bring your money. How do I know you won't take a powder?
No.
All right, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll send a boy around to your room in 5 minutes. You better have the money, or it's going to be all around Chicago that you're welched. You won't be able to get a game of jacks.
Sounds old-fashioned, but it was a fun, winking movie at the time. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join the conversation. Let's go to Jason in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jason, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi.
My favorite scene with Mr. Newman is going back to the 60s, not in movie life, but in actual life. I grew up in the town where the Newmans lived, and he was my customer one day at a
This is in Connecticut, Westport, Connecticut?
Yeah, that's right. And, most people who came in there were housewives or ladies who wanted, you know, a small bag of tomatoes or something. So this guy comes into a sports car. He doesn't say much. I don't recognize him because he's got opaque aviator shades on. He wants about 3 bags of corn, which comes to around 100 pounds. He wants a half a dozen bags of charcoal briquettes and asks if we have any club soda. He wants a couple of cases, and I told him that, you know, we're a farm stand. We don't sell cocktail mixers. He gets in his car, a silver brand-new Porsche, takes off in a cloud of gravel and dust, and I'm thinking to myself, was that Mr. Newman? and of course, who else could it have been? But he had this affect of, you know, both tough. My impression was like both tough and a little vulnerable. And I didn't expect it to be Mr. Newman because he was shorter than I imagined, of course. But, you know, that scene is as vivid in my mind 40 years ago as any from the movie.
Jason, you paint it like a movie critic and put us right there in the farm stand with the cool guy right in front of you. Thanks very much. Let's get one from Augusta, Georgia. Ken, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the comment that art really does have a way of positively affected society. I watched The Verdict probably a half a dozen times between my junior and senior year in high school, and it was one of the real influences that made me decide to go to law school. I just thought, I didn't know any lawyers personally, but his character, his lead role in that movie, just demonstrated a flawed but really principled person. And it's just an example of how art really does, I think, have profound impact on individuals.
1982, The Verdict, and even though, Ken, he was so down on his luck, alcoholic lawyer, it took you into law.
The classical, in a sense, he was a tragic, a tragedy at one point in his life, but he again found the courage that apparently rectified all character flaws that people had. I just thought it was amazing. I mean, it was just such an honorable character.
Ken, it's wonderful to get your testimony on that. Mark Harris, this was a time when Newman, after having kind of drifted away from movies and it seemed to many having lost interest and having suffered losses in his personal life, was beginning to dig down again and bring something deeper, fresh, new to his movies.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the 70s weren't a great time to be a traditional movie star. You had this whole wave of guys like Al Pacino and John Travolta and Dustin Hoffman who didn't necessarily look like ordinary movie stars getting all the attention. And Paul Newman, you know, he turned 50 in the 1970s. He seemed less interested in movies than he had been. He took a lot of paycheck roles, things like The Towering Inferno. And, you know, the irony that Jack was talking about could work against him in that you could sometimes, in really bad movies, see him standing very far outside the characters he was playing. And then in the 1980s, you see him do something that you almost never see an actor in his mid-50s do, which is suddenly decide he wants to go much deeper. And he starts putting together this string of performances in Fort Apache, the Bronx, in Absence of Malice, in The Verdict, in The Color of Money, where he returns to play Fast Eddie Felsen, where you see him digging deeper, suddenly being perhaps less interested in characters that he can play with that veneer of slight irony that he was so comfortable with, and really go toward their frailty and their weakness and their humanity. And I think one reason The Verdict is so effective is because it's not a movie about a hero. It's a movie about a deeply flawed, weak human being who finds some heroism within himself, which is much more affecting.
1978, Paul Newman's only son, several daughters, but only son died from an accidental drug and alcohol overdose, and you've written, Mark, something happened to him. Then, of course, soon we see The Verdict. Let's listen to just a little bit of Paul Newman digging down for new levels in an acting career. He's playing Frank Galvin, the down-on-his-luck alcoholic lawyer, pushes a medical malpractice case to trial to try to salvage his own career. In his closing statements to the jury, Newman, Frank Galvin, talks about justice and the plight of the human condition.
You know, so much of the time we're just lost. We say, please, God, tell us what is right. Tell us what is true. I mean, there is no justice. The rich win, the poor are powerless. We become tired of hearing people lie. And after a time, we become dead. A little dead. We think of ourselves as victims. And we become victims. We become weak.
Paul Newman, 1982, in The Verdict. Let's get a call from Steve in Fort Myers, Florida. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be a listener. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not a deep movie watcher, but every once in a while, a performance occurs that just makes you want to see it again and again. Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men, Sally Field at the graveside of her daughter in Steel Magnolias. Mm-hmm. And as you were just talking, and it was good to hear it, Frank Galvin's final statement in The Verdict, goodness gracious, it helps us remember the passion. It helps us remember the emotion, and these are things that I just really enjoy in my movie watching experiences. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve, very much for calling. Janine, interestingly, it was about the same time, 1982, that Paul Newman started this whole second life as the entrepreneur. He was launching his Newman's Own line of salad dressings. It sounds kind of pedestrian up against that passion and emotion, but he raised something like $250 million in the balance of his life for kids and charity with this extraordinary and kind of unprecedented stretch into putting his face not just on the screen but on a bottle of dressing, on a package of popcorn.
It's so interesting that he didn't want to be the glamorous movie star, but finally found something good to do with his face,
yeah.
Which was put it on food so that money could be raised to help children with cancer and the various philanthropies that he supported. And, you know, in the state of Connecticut, I mean, Paul Newman is a lot more than a movie star to people for what he's done. His philanthropy is astonishing. And, you know, it's a kind of old Midwestern roots thing that he had, and he gave out statements about it, talking about, you know, you need to put something back in. And he was one hugely successful star who actually did put something back in a very profound way. That's a lot of money generated by the food, and he gave it to worthy causes, and that's a great thing. I mean, you know, not many do that.
We're up against the clock. We'll come back and look at that and much more. Here's music from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Burt Bacharach, Janine Basinger, Mark Harris, Jack Beatty. Please stand by. We're talking about Paul Newman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you. We are remembering Paul Newman this hour, icon, actor, activist, entrepreneur, and his extraordinary career in movies and beyond. Mark Harris is with us, author of Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood. Janine Basinger is with us from Wesleyan University, author of The Star Machine, and Jack Beatty's here. Let's get a call from Martin in Fairfax, Connecticut. Martin, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. It's Fairfax, South Carolina.
Sorry.
Two points. A lesser-known film of him from the later period that I really love is Fat Man and Little Boy, where he played General Leslie Groves. Great film. But this is a point. I had heard in my younger years that, you know, regarding his good looks and his famous blue eyes, that he could be self-deprecating. He supposedly, there's a line that he said he wanted his tombstone epitaph to read, "He was all right till his eyes turned brown." And I was just wondering if anybody had heard that comment or could speak to the veracity of it.
Thanks for your call, Martin. I have seen that line. I've got it here in front of me. It says, Paul Newman saying, I'm not sure what year, but I picture my epitaph. Here lies Paul Newman, who died a failure because his eyes turned brown. I don't know, Mark, Janine, Jack, does anybody...
I think that's absolutely a real line.
I think so, yes.
And mocking the sort of famous beauty of those blue eyes and what he might be without them.
Yeah, I mean, one frustrating thing about Paul Newman is that over 50 years, he managed almost never to give an interview where he talked seriously about acting. He just wasn't interested at all in going into deep discussions of his craft. It's almost as if he thought it was silly, but he certainly didn't treat it lightly. I mean, he took it very seriously when he was doing the work, especially as he got older. He just he often brushed off any kind of discussions of his beauty or his talent with a joke.
There was one bit, a little conversation he had with our NPR colleague Terry Gross in 2003. Terry asked him if he was aware of the fact that he had been a part of a new generation of actors bringing change to Hollywood.
Well, I don't know at the time that you really know that you're part of something new. You just know that you're part of something that's really exciting. And I certainly did feel that. Although I must say, I had no idea what I was doing until maybe 10 years ago.
Why do you say that? I mean, no one will agree with you on that.
Well, what is, and I take a look at all that stuff that I did previous to this, and wish I had a chance to take another crack at it.
Is there something that you would really do different that you could put your finger on?
Less is more.
Paul Newman with Terry Gross on Fresh Air in 2003 saying he didn't know what he was doing until 10 years before that, when he would have been, Janine Basinger, nearly 70 before he knew what he was doing by that accounting.
No, well, you know, what's interesting is that he is an actor who does have craft and who had studied the craft of acting, which a lot of movie stars didn't. So I guess he really had respect for it. He was one movie star who was willing to be a character actor, and he was headed that direction from the very beginning and using the craft to get there. But as Mark says, it's frustrating that he wouldn't discuss it, but it was just a tradition that he had, that he maintained, self-deprecating, don't talk about it too much, deny you're beautiful, deny whatever. It was a style he had, and that too may just be one of those Midwestern things, but he had real acting craft and had studied it, and that's what took him forward and made him able to give us a performance like that, very rich and nuanced one that he gives in The Verdict, which is surely one of the great performances by any movie actor or movie star.
Jack Beatty, less is more is the sort of Zen Master Newman's takeaway there with Terry Gross.
Yeah, and he's referring there to technique, to really paring it down. And I'm go back to Mark's excellent point. It's the post-irony Newman, the Newman who just talks it out, who seems so real. There's nothing separate, nothing being held back. On the other hand, there's no histrionic. It's just, it's almost minimalist, and yet it's, and for all that, and because of that, it's so real. And, you know, there's the other side of him, too. We don't have time to talk about it, but to his everlasting honor, he was number 19 on Nixon's enemies list. He campaigned for Gene McCarthy. Into the 80s, he was one of the leaders, really, in the American nuclear weapons control movement.
Ban the bomb.
Yeah, and the nuclear freeze, mm-hmm. and, you know, worried about the ultimate threat to life. So he was, that's a whole side of him. And, of course, he was a patron and a funder of the Nation. So, and Jeanine, I read to my surprise that there was actually some talk that he might have challenged Joe Lieberman in 2006.
Yes, we were all up for that. You know, the interesting thing is that he was one star who wasn't going to give up citizenship just because he was in the limelight as a movie star. He always insisted on, you know, he was going to be a citizen, speak out on what he wanted to speak out on and be involved in political issues. And he was very courageous and outward going in that, because a lot of stars would be afraid that they might lose audience as a result of that, and that was something he was not concerned about. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it speaks a lot to who he is. On screen and off screen, he had something to bring on screen from off screen, because he did have a life. He did pay attention to other things besides just acting.
And on screen, he certainly didn't demand to be grand. 1994, Newman played Donald Sully Sullivan in Nobody's Fool. Here, he's a 60-year-old intermittent construction worker living in a small, snowbound town, North Bath, New York. One day, here's a clip where he accidentally runs into his estranged adult son, and throughout the movie, begins to make amends for abandoning him as a child. In this scene, Sully, Newman, and his son Peter, played by Dylan Walsh, pull up to see the abandoned house in which Sully grew up, and Newman, Sully, remembers his tumultuous childhood.
I grew up here. It was my father's house. As far as I'm concerned, it couldn't rot. He was some piece of work, your grandfather.
That good, huh?
Yeah, he was good when he was sober, but then I don't think anybody ever saw him sober. Your grandmother took the worst of it. She was just a tiny little woman. My God, he could make her fly. One minute she'd be standing over there, and the next minute she'd be on the opposite side of the room, just sitting on the floor. I made the mistake once of trying to get in between them. I don't know, I was 12 or something, and he didn't much care for that. I thought he was going to kill me.
My God, he could make her fly, Paul Newman saying there in Nobody's Fool. Mark Harris, you write that the weaknesses of the men he chose to play may be his most lasting legacy, though there's strength right there in acknowledging weakness.
There's great strength, and there's great minimalism, too. That is the performance that I think Paul Newman is talking about in that Terry Gross interview when he says 10 years ago is I mean, that's a very minimalist. There's no artifice, no actorishness in it at all. I'm so glad that his activism was brought up, though, because when we talk about his legacy, you know, he leaves obviously an incredible run of movies behind, but I think he also has a deep legacy that persists in the way that people like George Clooney and Leonardo DiCaprio are shaping their careers, not just because they're great-looking men who are less interested in being great-looking on screen than in finding great roles, but because Newman also gave them a model to follow in terms of combining activism, mm-hmm. social activism and political activism with movie stardom in a way that really no one had done as effectively as he had before.
And not too proud to put it right there on the popcorn, too. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and William. William, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, I kind of feel like Paul Newman is maybe one of the few truly humble people that I've known in, or you known about in public life, and especially acting, of course. But, you know, we all struggle with vanity, even those of us who are not beautiful. And I think I kind of get the impression that he knew that his looks, you know, helped get him where he was, but then he used that to, you know, to do good work. And he was interested in doing good work and being a human being and in quality. And I think he probably considers his looks at that point, you know, trivial.
He never forgot their impact. He hardly could, the way people responded to him. But I think you're exactly right, William. He wanted to get beyond them and did, trivial or not. Thank you for that. Let's get a call from Lexington, Massachusetts. And Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I worked on the advertising for Paul's first film that he directed, which was Sometimes a Great Notion. This was way back in about 1970.
Ken Kesey novel made into a movie?
I think so, that's right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was in a private screening with him, and right at the crucial dramatic part of the film where he is trying to save his brother, from the back of the screening room comes, pshht, Paul Newman had popped a bottle of beer. And it was...
Unimpressed by the high drama of the moment.
So modest. What a lovely man he was.
I love it. That's a great tale. Thank you very much, Ray. And let's get another from Evan in Woodbridge, Connecticut, back in Newman territory. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Tom. I guess for me, the most important thing about Newman, and actually the most important thing about his politics, had to do with the image of masculinity he projected on the screen. I mean, no one has mentioned, and it's one of my favorite films, along with The Sting in the early 70s, is Slapshot, where he plays this kind of over-the-hill hockey coach who has to choose, in order to save this town, this working-class town, between putting very violent players, the Hansen brothers, I think they were called, on the ice, or playing, quote, old-time hockey. And while he does resort to sort of violent tactics for the championship game, when the opposition has marshaled all of the killers from the rest of the league, presumably to destroy Newman's team, he orders them out on the ice to play old-time hockey. And some of you will remember one of the players, a Princeton graduate, ends the game by effectively doing a striptease on the ice and capturing the attention of the crowd.
That's one way.
And everyone in the crowd is horrified by the nudity, but apparently not by the violence. So I just wanted to say that, yeah, I never thought Newman was a great actor, but I thought he was played great roles. And I think he created an image of masculinity. I wouldn't say it was non-sexual. I think he used his sex very actively,
mm-hmm.
certainly in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, but what I was going to say is I think it was a sexuality without violence and aggression, a kind of passive sexuality, which I guess reaches its peak in the buddy movies, you know, like HUD or Sundance Kid and
yep.
so forth. And I think it was really an image of masculinity that was very important in the 1960s for millions of people who became fathers and sons and brothers and friends. And for that, I'll always be thankful to Newman.
Not just struck in the saddle leather and the jut jaw. Evan, thanks very much for that. Janine Basinger, what about Newman's sexuality on screen and off? And Evan just threw away there the notion that maybe not a great actor. Well, he had, what, 9 or 10 Oscar nominations and took home one for Color of Money and a couple of others honorary.
Yeah, sometimes, I mean, you know, when I look at his career, I mean, there's lots of great performances we don't have time to talk about. But, you know, you have HUD, Cool Hand Luke, Butch Cassidy, Fast Eddie. I mean, you're creating four of the most famous and iconic figures of film history there.
Yeah.
And although they're all played by Paul Newman and they all have a core that's Newman-esque, they have subtle variations that can only be brought by a great actor. He can do cool detachment and moody rebellion, and those are sort of opposites. And he's quite deceptive in what he can do, and I think it's... you know, it's easy to say there's no acting there when there's great acting sometimes, and that would be, I think he became a master of the technique and the craft of acting as he aged and really gave us a lot. His sex appeal,
Absolutely. Don't forget that, you know, he smoldered in those, like, John O'Hara characters, like in From the Terrace. And, you know, women would all, I think, say, no, we would be willing to put him forward as, you know, a great American sex symbol. The thing is that he took it away from us. I mean, he just wouldn't go there and insisted on making his career more than that, but certainly he had real sex appeal and a real sexuality for viewers. And, you know, that is, we are what we see when it comes to that. As Newman said, it is what it is. So, you know, we all see in him what we think we want out of it in that regard, but I don't think he left his career at the sexuality level. He moved it on to try to make it bigger or deeper or more meaningful or more subtle than that.
Jack, we've only got a minute left. Do you think, do Americans still take their cues, let's say American men, on manhood from the silver screen? It, my sense is there was a time when people really did inform their self understanding that way. Now we've got, what, 40-year-old virgin and, you know, lots of slapstick. Not only that, but is it still up there on the screen to be found, Jack, or not?
I just don't think we have movie stars anymore, the larger than life. I mean, there was that whole publicity machinery behind them, too. And, you know, we've had now two callers say that he shaped their lives. Mm. Isn't that something?
Yes, it is. He, you know, in The Hustler, Newman says, I'm the best there is. Even if you beat me, I'm still the best. And in a way, you know, that's what we're talking about here, is however you want to see him or however you take it, role model, not role model, whether he wins or he loses, he endures. And that was a both on and off screen thing for him.
We'll take that as a great last word. Janine Basinger at Wesleyan University, author of The Star Machine. Janine, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
And Mark Harris with Entertainment Weekly, author of Pictures at a Revolution. Mark, wonderful to have you.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Jack Beatty, enjoy those films.
I will. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook, remembering Paul Newman. This is On Point.